Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. This week we continue our offering of the best of Talking History, or at least the most popular programs of the past year, based on listener response and visits to our website archive of shows at oih.org. We present our program from the week of November 18, 2002, which features an interview with Joanne Meyerowitz on Christine Jorgensen and a commentary by Robert Brent Toplin on dishonesty on Wall Street and in the corporate boardrooms. We take up the program with Joey Skidmore's This Week in History.
This Week in History, on November 19, 1863, President Lincoln succinctly and eloquently articulated an enduring vision of America. The speech, delivered at the dedication of the military cemetery at Gettysburg, brought renewed meaning to a people disillusioned by civil war. On July 1, 1863, following his victory at Chancellorsville, Confederate General Robert E. Lee invaded the North and encountered Union cavalry west of Gettysburg, and so the greatest battle of the Civil War began, and when it was over, 23,000 Union men and 25,000 Confederate soldiers lay dead, wounded, or were missing. On July 4th, Lee withdrew, marking the turning point in the war and prompting Lincoln's speech. Contrary to popular myth, the speech took some time to craft. Lincoln had been planning to publicly state the reasons for the Civil War and the fight against slavery. All he needed was the right moment. At Gettysburg, he prompted the crowd to reflect on the vision of the Founding Fathers that the nation was dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal, and to honor the dead by resolving that the dead shall not have died in vain, that this nation, under God, shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, for the people shall not perish from the earth.
Turning to items of historical interest in the news, this year we celebrate the 75th anniversary of the invention of the television. NBC took the lead in this celebration by airing a series of specials, marking its own 75 years as a radio and television network. But neither NBC nor any other of the major networks have made note of the person who actually invented the television, Philo T. Farnsworth. Farnsworth successfully transmitted the first video image, a horizontal line, on September 7, 1927. Residents of Goldfield, Nevada, recently celebrated the mining town's 100th anniversary, in the midst of which they were paid an unexpected visit by Wyatt Earp's grandson. The town welcomed him with open arms. They made him an honorary sheriff's deputy. Locals posed for photographs with him and listened as he talked about the famous lawman who owned a saloon in nearby Tonopah and whose brother Virgil was a sheriff's deputy in Goldfield. Unfortunately, the man was an impostor. An archaeologist had discovered the skeleton of a man they believe may be John the Baptist. The discovery took place in a graveyard at the Qumran site on the West Bank where the Dead Sea Scrolls were found a half century ago. Given the person's elaborate burial, they theorized that he was the teacher of righteousness to whom the Essenes refer in the scrolls, and that the person may be John the Baptist. Others are skeptical, pointing out, for one thing, that the skeleton still has its head. This is Talking History.
And disgrace, then he was all right. The band was on.
1952, a newspaper headline read, XGI becomes blonde beauty. The nation was more than a little surprised, shocked, and even scandalized. The headline referred to Christine Jorgensen, the subject of a new book by Joanne Meyerowitz. Talking History's Jim Madison recently interviewed Professor Meyerowitz about her book and the significance of this event.
This is Jim Madison for Talking History. My guest today is Joanne Meyerowitz, professor of history at Indiana University, where she's also the editor of the Journal of American History, the leading scholarly journal for United States history. Professor Meyerowitz is the author of a new book. The title is How Sex Changed, A History of Transsexuality, published this year by Harvard University Press. And it is that book and the subject of sex and transsexuality that we want to talk about today. Welcome, Joanne.
Thank you.
Let's begin with getting a sense of why you decided to write this particular book.
Well, for the past 10 years or so, I've been doing research on issues of gender and sexuality in the post-World War II era. And while I was doing this research, I stumbled over Christine Jorgensen. I think I was in the reading room of the Library of Congress looking at popular magazines, and I encountered an article on Christine Jorgensen. One of the very first I stumbled over was in True Confessions magazine of 1954, and it was an interview with Jorgensen. And after I read that first article, she started showing up everywhere I looked. She was in the New York Times. She was in One magazine, which was a tiny magazine of the fledgling homophile or early gay rights movement. She was in Time, she was in Newsweek, she was everywhere you'd look. And I was taken in by this. Jorgensen was a male-to-female transsexual. She was born in the Bronx in 1926 as George Jorgensen, Jr. She went to Denmark in 1950 in search of sex change surgery. She had had since childhood this long-standing, irrepressible desire to live her life as a woman. And in Denmark, she found some doctors who were willing to experiment on her, and she came back to the United States in 1953. But before that, in December of 1952, her story made the news while she was recovering in a hospital bed in Copenhagen. And the New York Daily News had this front page banner headline reading, XGI becomes blonde beauty. And after that, she became a media celebrity. So I stumbled upon some of the articles from this moment of her celebrity in the early 1950s, and I was especially intrigued because she raised all sorts of issues that are significant for 20th century history. Here she was talking about the promise and pitfalls of science and technology in the atomic age. And here she was talking about what makes a man and what makes a woman, what's appropriate behavior for men and women, who counts as a man and who counts as a woman, what's normal and what's abnormal. And so she was raising all sorts of intriguing issues, and I was hooked. I went back, though, to the history books of the 1950s and 1960s, and she was nowhere in them. And yet she was a household name through the 1950s and 60s. She was a major figure. She was the source of a media circus. The media started, the reporters followed her. They dogged her every move. In Copenhagen, when she returned to the United States in February 1953, they followed her parents at their home in the Bronx. There were hundreds of articles in the press about Christine Jorgensen, not just in 1952 and 1953, but for years afterwards.
Why was she so interesting to the media? And did the media sensationalize her? Did they deal with this in a serious sort of way, or was it sensationalism?
It was both, and it depends on where you read. Yeah. Jorgensen was both in very sober articles in the mainstream press, and she was also completely sensationalized in trashy pulp magazines. Mm-hmm. So there were all sorts of stories about her. There was a tremendous public curiosity about her. What happened was that the reporters realized that the public wanted more. And with each story, they asked certain questions, and she provided certain answers, and it just egged the publicity on.
So she cooperated with the publicity? She was willing to be interviewed and to have her story told?
She was. She was someone who always loved the limelight. Mm. And in fact, she was likely the one who tipped off the press in the first place.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So she was not exactly a publicity hound, but she certainly liked the limelight, although I think she was wholly stunned at the level of celebrity she reached.
Was she committed to a cause, or was it just her own personal celebrity seeking?
No, I think she was deeply committed to a cause. She had lived a life in which she had been roundly ridiculed, and she saw that happening to other people, and she felt firmly that she was a missionary of sorts, speaking out not only for herself but for others like her.
Why was she ridiculed?
Well, anyone, I think, who in that
she was
era...
She ridiculed as George, you mean?
Yes.
Or as Christine and George and Christine, really?
Well, yes, probably both, but especially as George. When she was a child, she was gender variant. She had feminine gestures and what one would think of as feminine traits, even though she was a boy. And that's a source of ridicule in our society.
Yes.
When I first got involved in this project, I just started collecting various articles in a folder on Jorgensen, and then I decided I had to pursue it. And the more I pursued it, the more I learned that Jorgensen wasn't the whole story, that she's a central character in the story, she's a key figure, but she isn't all of it. She was not the first transsexual. She was not even the first American transsexual. She was not even the first transsexual to make it into the popular press. And so the book that I ended up writing has Jorgensen as one chapter and as a central character, but she's not there everywhere. And the book starts in the early 20th century with the first publicized experiments to change the sex of animals and ends at the end of the 20th century with an emerging movement for transsexual and transgender rights.
So you're the historian in this way who's providing the context that explains Jorgensen's story but explains much more than just this one person's history.
Exactly. Yes. That's my goal.
That's your goal. Yes, right. Well, tell us a little more about the context, if you can. In fact, you write at one point that that American society had sexualized by the first half of the century. Can you explain that and provide some more of the context that makes Jorgensen's story so interesting?
From the early 20th century on, sex was pretty much everywhere in American society, and sex had a lot of different meanings. From the early women's movement in the early 20th century on, there was all sorts of discussion of sex differences, the differences between men and women. From the early sex researchers, sexologists such as Freud, there was all sorts of talk about sexuality and its meanings in American life. In advertising, in the movies, there was clearly the notion that sex sold, and sexuality was used as a way to attract readers and buyers and audiences. And so sex was pretty much everywhere in American culture by the time Jorgensen arrived on the scene, and yet she crystallized some questions for people. She was able to raise some issues. She was able to bring into the public culture some questions of sex and gender and sexuality in ways that they hadn't been there before.
But still, there's a time, even as late as the 1950s, when many Americans did not want sex to be discussed in public. Is that not the case?
That is the case.
Yeah. So she's pushing against that kind of an issue?
She is pushing against that, and she is able to bring issues of sex into the public in ways some other people couldn't. She presents herself as a very respectable, ladylike public figure, and the reporters are at first obsessed with looking at her, with trying to figure out, does she look like a woman or does she look like a man? And so she forces virtually everyone who looks at her to do a double take and say, what makes one qualify as a woman and what makes one qualify as a man? And so she just raises that just by her very presence. She's literally embodying the questions of what is gender. She doesn't raise the racier issues of sexuality that might have been taboo in the popular culture of the 1950s. She's able to do this in a way where she maintains a very ladylike demeanor. She does this on purpose. And so she frames her story in a way that makes her a sympathetic character so that she can address some of these issues in a climate where the racier sides of sexuality are still taboo.
Right. Your book is titled How Sex Changed. I sense that there's more than one meaning to that title.
There is indeed. The most obvious meaning is that I'm referring to the emergence in the 20th century of sex change surgery, how sex changed. The book traces how it came to be that certain people with a sense of cross-gender identification came to ask doctors to change their bodily sex, and how it came to be that some doctors started to prescribe hormones and perform surgeries for that purpose. The other side of how sex changed is that the title also refers to our definitions of biological sex and how they changed over the course of the 20th century. The doctors and scientists who studied sex change were forced to come up with definitions of maleness and femaleness, and these were different at the end of the 20th century than at the beginning. And eventually, the doctors' definitions make their way into court. Transsexuals go to court from the late 1960s on, asking to change their legal sex or for other reasons, and then judges are asked to define sex, who counts as a male, who counts as a female in a legal setting. So this book is a history of transsexuality, and it's also a history of how the definitions of sex have changed over the course of the 20th century.
Let me ask you to go back to some basics here, which still may not be familiar to all of us, and that is, you talk about sex, you talk about gender, you talk about sexuality. These are all certain kinds of categories, but they're confusing to many of us.
I think today, at least among academics, we're fairly used to distinguishing among sex, gender, and sexuality. And when we talk about sex or biological sex, we're generally referring to the physical characteristics of sex, things like genitals and reproductive organs and chromosomes. But when we talk about gender, we're generally talking about masculinity and femininity, the kinds of things that are associated with maleness and femaleness, but might well result from a particular society's construction of maleness and femaleness. It's not the physical characteristics of sex. And when we talk about sexuality, we're talking about the erotic desires and erotic behaviors. And so we distinguish sex, gender, and sexuality. They're inextricably intertwined. We can never distinguish them entirely. And back at the beginning of the 20th century, almost no one distinguished among them. In fact, when they talked about sex, they meant all of those things. And when they had a certain biological determinism, there were a few dissenters at the time, but by far among scientists and in the popular culture, the general consensus was that sex referred not only to the physical characteristics of sex, but that those physical characteristics of sex determined certain traits that were masculine and feminine and determined certain kinds of sexual or erotic behaviors. And so what they lump together, we tend to take apart, but it's sticky. We can't really pull them entirely apart.
And in this early 20th century period, then, the differences between male and female were seen to be very stark and very absolute. Is that the case or not?
Not really.
No?
One of the interesting things I discovered was that among the earliest experimenters, the doctors and scientists who experimented with sex change surgery, there was an interesting theory about sex. And that early theory they had through the early 20th century was a concept of overlapping sexes. They believed that every human being had both male and female aspects, that there was physically intermixed in every body aspects of the male and aspects of the female. And they called this the theory of universal bisexuality, meaning two sexes in one body. And this was a very widespread, frequently voiced theory about human sex. What they said about people who we would now call transsexuals was that they were more mixed than everyone else. There's this spectrum of sex. No one's 100% male. No one's 100% female. But some people are more mixed up than others. Mm-hmm. And that's how we would account for someone like Christine Jorgensen.
But for the ordinary American, even as late as the 1950s, for many ordinary Americans, this must have been hard to accept. And it must have been hard to accept Christine Jorgensen. Was there criticism as to what she had done? Was there opposition to the whole idea of transsexuality in the 1950s?
Yes, there was opposition. There was a lot of curiosity, I think, even more so than opposition. Jorgensen and her doctors used her celebrity to popularize that theory of overlapping sexes. This was her mantra. She repeatedly stated, no one is 100% male or 100% female, and her doctors said the same thing. This was in the United States, the heyday of that particular theory of overlapping sexes. So that's part of what she did. There was a lot of curiosity about her. She was, because of the way she told her story, she evoked quite a bit of sympathy, but she also evoked ridicule, and there were lots of jokes about her, and some people saw her as a freak. So there was definitely some opposition. Among the doctors, there was also some opposition in the 1950s to sex change surgery. In fact, most American doctors were reluctant to advocate any such surgery in the United States. This is why Jorgensen ended up going to Denmark to get the surgery done. The most vocal opponents of sex change surgery in the United States in the 50s and later among the doctors were the psychoanalysts.
Well, it's a fascinating story. Thank you, Joanne Marowitz. We've been listening to an interview for Talking History with Professor Joanne Marowitz of Indiana University, who's the author of a new book titled How Sex Changed, A History of Transsexuality, published this year by Harvard University Press. Thank you.
Holly came from Miami, FLA. Hitchhiked her way across the USA. Plucked her eyebrows on the way. Shaved her legs and then he was a she. She says, hey babe, take a walk on the wild side. Said, hey honey, take a walk on the wild side.
Continuing on our subject of sex in America, for our site of the week, we have selected a new museum dedicated to the history of sex. Here to tell you about it is Talking History's Joey Skidmore.
On September 28th, the Museum of Sex opened its doors to the public. Its mission is to preserve and present the history, evolution, and cultural significance of human sexuality through exhibitions, no pun intended, programs, and publications representing the best in current scholarship. Its inaugural exhibition is New York City Sex, How New York City Transformed Sex in America. It focuses on the history of sexual subcultures in New York, charting the influence of the city and its citizens in creating modern American ideas about sex and sexuality. Bronx resident Christine Jorgensen is included, but so are Margaret Sanger, Mae West, Robert Mapplethorpe, and many other interesting historical characters. The Museum of Sex is located on Fifth Avenue in New York City.
And if you go to New York to visit the Museum of Sex before January 5th, you might want to subway over to Brooklyn to visit the Brooklyn Museum of Art and its show, Exposed, the Victorian Nude. If you spend any time looking at art, you have no doubt come to take the naked body and art for granted. You simply can't go to a museum without encountering many nudes. So we're often lulled into forgetting how controversial nudity has been in the United States, outside the museum, and occasionally within. The Brooklyn Museum exhibit lays bare, so to speak, some of these issues, even though the nudes in its show were painted more than a century ago, in the era well known for its prudery. The exhibit examines the often heated debates that surrounded exposure of the naked body, even as nudes proliferated on the walls of Victorian salons. Exposed, the Victorian Nude will be at the Brooklyn Museum of Art through January 5th. Finally, we turn to our commentary of the week. Robert Brent Toplin is a professor of history at the University of North Carolina at Wilmington. One of his specialties is the study of how history is represented in the movies. In this week's commentary on the current afflictions of big business in the United States, Toplin recalls the character Gordon Gekko from the movie Wall Street and looks back to history for some lessons on how we've dealt with corporate corruption.
Greed is good, said Gordon Gekko when addressing a stockholders' meeting in Oliver Stone's 1987 movie Wall Street. Gekko, an arrogant power broker, used insider knowledge to organize corporate buyouts that produced millions for himself while leaving others in ruin. Gekko's words still resonate in this year of fast-breaking news about corporate malpractice. The Gekko character is a familiar figure in United States economic history. His most notable earlier appearance was in the 1920s. In that decade, a time of fast-rising stock prices, manipulative financiers gave the public distorted information about the condition of their business enterprises. Often they stuffed their pockets with cash while unloading highly questionable securities on the American people. Then, in the late 1920s and early 1930s, their empires collapsed like a house of cards. Millions of unsuspecting investors went crashing down with them. During the 1930s, President Franklin D. Roosevelt found a way to deal with these troublesome Gordon Geckos of yesteryear. His administration established new rules for corporate behavior. The Glass-Steagall Act reduced conflicts of interest by separating commercial and investment banking, and the Securities and Exchange Commission required that stock offerings contain detailed financial information for investors. The legacy of regulation passed down to us from FDR's New Deal is difficult to revive today. A laissez-faire philosophy now receives almost religious devotion on Wall Street and Pennsylvania Avenue. Brokers and politicians recite a familiar mantra, claiming that federal regulation tends to retard economic growth. These advocates of a hands-off policy fail to see, as many New Dealers did, that regulation can be a useful means for promoting honest and equitable business practices. Nor do they recognize, as the New Dealers did, that effective regulation helps to restore public confidence in the stock market and produce better conditions for economic progress. If Americans remember the lessons of Wall Street, they are likely to give the modern-day Gordon Geckos their comeuppance. Oliver Stone's movie, after all, was not just a morality play about the evils of avarice. It carried a practical message. What was good for Gordon Gecko, the movie suggested, was not necessarily good for the economy or the American people. The movie provided a Hollywood solution to the problem. In the final minutes, Gecko's young protege turned him in to the authorities. In real life, it takes more than a single heroic figure to deal with the challenges posed by excessive greed. Government must establish the rules of fair play.
You've been listening to Robert Brent Toplin, author of Real History, Hollywood Interprets the Past. Toplin's commentary comes to us courtesy of the History News Service. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed the show. We invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History, University of Missouri, Kansas City, Kansas City, Missouri, 64110. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians. Information about the OAH and Talking History is available at oah.org. Until next time, this is your host, Brian LeBeau.
I met her in the club down in Otoho, where you drink champagne and it tastes just like cherry cola. C-O-L-A cola. She walked up to me and she asked me to dance. I asked her her name and in a dark brown voice she said Lola. L-O-L-A, Lola. Lola, Lola, Lola.
We hope you've enjoyed the best of Talking History. Be sure to join us again next week for an all-new episode.